So thanks so much, Zach. Can everybody hear me? All right. First of all, Feliz Cinco de Mayo. I spilled beer already. I'm only one beer in. Anyway, thank you all for coming tonight. It's really, really cool to see such a big crowd here. It's been a while, I think, since I lectured in front of a group this big. So hopefully we can have some fun tonight. I promise it'll be more fun if you have beer or wine, those of you that are of age. And we'll tell you a little bit about some fossil discoveries that some colleagues and I are making in China and also in Antarctica, and what those discoveries mean for our understanding of the origins of the birds that fly around us today. And that brings us to our first slide here. Modern birds are the most diverse group of land-living backboned animals. There's more than 10,000 species of birds alive today. And of course, they encompass this vast array of different kinds of creatures, you know, from toucans to kiwis to ostriches to penguins. How did birds come to be? And that's the question that we're going to try to at least discuss. I don't think we're going to be able to answer it tonight, but we're going to try to talk about it a little bit, and hopefully you guys will come to agree with some of the things that my collaborators and I think about this question. The question is, how does a thing like a chicken, like this bird here, come to be? Well, in some ways, some parts of this evolutionary transition are well documented, and that's documented thanks to really extraordinary fossil discoveries. Perhaps the most famous, and certainly one of the most important of these fossil discoveries, is that of Archaeopteryx. And this is a bird that was first discovered, and actually the first good skeleton of it was discovered only 2 years after Charles Darwin published his book, The Origin of Species. So Darwin advances the theory of evolution in 1859 with the publication of this book. And one of the major holes in that theory to that point, I guess it was a hypothesis at that point, since it hadn't really been established yet, one of the major holes in that hypothesis was, you know, where are the transitional animals in the fossil record? And not 2 years later, out of a quarry in southern Germany comes tumbling Archaeopteryx. This is an animal that combines some of the classic features of reptiles and birds. A long, bony tail like a reptile, claws on the wings, unfused hand and foot bones, teeth in the jaws, but most importantly, feathers on the wings. These stripes here, these are impressions of feathers on the wings and also on the tail. Archaeopteryx is an animal that in a lot of ways is something like half reptile, half bird. In a lot of ways, it's evolution caught in the act, an animal caught in the act of changing. And this is exactly what Darwin had predicted would be found. And it was, not long after his publication. But I'm not going to pontificate on Archaeopteryx too much more, other than to say that this is an extraordinarily significant fossil for our understanding of bird evolution. And one of the reasons it's significant is that Archaeopteryx, in many ways, is a link between reptiles and birds. It's got, as I said, many different features, many features on one side that we associate with reptiles, and many features on the other that we associate with birds. And thanks to new fossil discoveries, more recent fossil discoveries, it's now been established which group of reptiles gave rise to birds. It was long recognized that birds were derived from some kind of reptile, but what that reptile was not certain for a very long time. We now know that it's animals like Velociraptor that gave rise to birds, and that effectively, in an evolutionary sense, birds are dinosaurs. So the 10,000 species of birds that you see flying around us today, you know, everything from, you know, the robin in your backyard to the ostrich running across the plains of Africa to the penguins, you know, floating around in Antarctica, every single one of those is, by definition, a living dinosaur. Birds are a branch on the dinosaur evolutionary tree, and so birds are dinosaurs. Now, this transition is well documented in the fossil record. We now know more about this transition than we do many other evolutionary transitions in the history of life. And this is because of spectacular fossil discoveries that have been made mostly in recent years. This was I have the good fortune to have lived through one of the most important events in the history of dinosaur paleontology, the history of what I do. I'm a dinosaur paleontologist by training. I focus on the study of dinosaurs and the fossil record. And when I was in graduate school, actually just before I was in graduate school in 1995, people were still arguing, scientists were still arguing about what group of reptiles gave rise to birds. And, you know, and it literally went back and forth for more than 100 years. Not long after Darwin first published The Origin of Species and Archaeopteryx was first discovered, a very famous evolutionary biologist named Thomas Henry Huxley advanced the idea that the group of reptiles that gave rise to birds were dinosaurs. And this idea actually held sway for many decades until the 1920s. With the publication of another book that argued that dinosaurs could not be the ancestors of birds. It had to be some other kind of animal, some other kind of reptile that was doing this. And so people, paleontologists had argued until they were blue in the face, you know, literally hundreds of scientific papers published on this. What group of reptiles gave rise to birds? You know, arguments back and forth, you know, good arguments on both sides. You know, it's dinosaurs, it's not dinosaurs, it's crocodiles, it's not crocodiles, whatever. Until in 1995, a farmer in northeastern China digs a dinosaur with feathers on it out of his field when he's, you know, he's digging for fossils in his backyard, normally plants corn in his backyard, finds a dinosaur with feathers on it. Feathers, the definitive characteristic of birds, and the story is over. That's it. I mean, you know, that's one of these scientific discoveries that sometimes scientific discoveries happen incrementally. We make little discoveries on the way to, you know, on the path to greater knowledge. This is one of those things where it would be like getting hit with a 2x4 scientifically. I mean, you know, beating you over the head that, yes, dinosaurs are the ancestors of birds. And that was an amazing thing to be able to live, to be in graduate school as this all was happening. That first feathered dinosaur was this creature here, Sinoceropteryx. And in the years that followed, many other feathered dinosaurs were discovered, animals like Microraptor and this creature here, Caudipteryx. And these animals, unlike Sinoceropteryx, which has sort of a fringe of kind of filamentous feathers along its back and tail, these animals have full-fledged feathers, long feathers on the wings and actually on the hind legs, also of Microraptor, long feathers on the wings and also on the tail of Caudipteryx. And I think you can see the feathers on Microraptor pretty well, probably not so much on Caudipteryx, you'll have to trust me. And then, in addition, I got to play a small part in this story recently. So hopefully some of you guys have heard of this. This is a dinosaur that a bunch of friends and I published 6 weeks ago, actually. And this was, it made some news because it has a catchy nickname, the chicken from hell. But it is another one of these very bird-like dinosaurs. Now, we didn't find feathers on this one, but we infer it to have feathers because it's closely related to the animal I showed you before, this creature here, Caudipteryx, which has been found with feathers. So it's very likely that this creature that we now call Anzu Wileyi, informally the chicken from hell, had feathers as well. So birds are dinosaurs, and this transition is well documented. But I jumped ahead one slide too much. What I'm going to talk about tonight is how you go from something like an Archaeopteryx to something like a chicken. This transition, this evolutionary transition, is relatively poorly documented in the fossil record, and I'm going to show you why. It's mostly because we don't have many fossils to show how you go from something with teeth in its jaws, a long bony tail, claws on its wings, to something like a chicken, you know, with toothless jaws and fused feet and short, you know, and not much of a tail at all. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight, is the transition from things like Archaeopteryx, primitive birds, to things like chickens, modern birds. So modern birds belong to the group called Neornithes. And we've already talked about Archaeopteryx. Archaeopteryx is about 150 million years old. Very early in the history of paleontology, people discovered members of modern bird groups from roughly 50 million years ago, a period of time that we call the Paleogene period. And these fossil birds, in many cases beautifully preserved, you can see, you know, wings, you can see, you know, soft tissues everywhere, really, really exquisite fossils. These are fossils of animals that, If you were to see them flying around today, you would be hard-pressed to distinguish them from modern types of birds. There are swifts, there are parrots, there are many other kinds of modern birds that we see. So these animals, even though they're quite ancient, they're 50 million years plus, these are animals that are members of modern bird groups, and so are very different from things like Archaeopteryx, and therefore don't tell us a whole lot about the transition from things like Archaeopteryx to things like modern birds. They are, effectively, anatomically speaking, modern birds themselves. So when we think about that gulf in time, the time of Archaeopteryx 150 million years ago, to some of these creatures that are found in the earliest part of the Paleogene, we're talking about a gulf in time of at least 80 million years. And this was a problem that vexed paleontologists for many, many decades. Thankfully, in recent years, it started to become filled in quite well. So we're going to talk a little bit about bird evolution here. And this is just an evolutionary tree of birds and a very, kind of a simplified one. But as we go along in the talk, we're going to fill in this tree with animals that are successively more closely related to modern birds. So the state of the art in the 1860s was Archaeopteryx on one side and modern birds on the other, and this vast gulf of evolutionary history in between. Basically an area where we'd put a big giant question mark as to what we know. Thankfully, in Liaoning province in northeastern China, and this is something, I'm going to talk about this province a little bit. This is a very famous place. It's a place that's, from a paleontological standpoint, extremely famous because it's home to these feathered dinosaurs. Most of these feathered dinosaurs have never been found anywhere else in the world. The fossil beds in Liaoning province are extraordinary, and they've yielded, unlike most other dinosaur-bearing rock deposits, these have yielded extensive soft tissues, skin, feathers, in the cases of mammals, fur, the types of things that we don't often see preserved in the fossil record. And we think this is because conditions at these sites in northeastern China were very special, very unusual, conducive to the preservation of structures that we don't normally get. So from these sites in northeastern China come many things, but one bird in particular, one very important bird, named Confucius ornus. And this is, you don't need me to tell you that this is an old bird from China. It's named after that. This is a bird that's, in a lot of ways, very similar to Archaeopteryx. It's very primitive in many ways, but it's got one feature that Archaeopteryx doesn't have, and that shows us that it's one step higher on the evolutionary tree. Confucius ornus lacks the long bony tail of Archaeopteryx. It's got a short bony tail like that of a modern bird. And as a result, we believe it's slightly more closely related. So if we add in Confucius ornus, we can shrink this gulf in time down to 60 million years or so. Still, 60 million years is a vast amount of time, and a lot can happen in a period of time like that. So we're going to continue to fill in this gulf, and not long after the origins of Confucius ornus, birds split into two main groups. And the group that we'll talk about now, this is a very, really, really interesting group. They're known as enantiornithines, or opposite birds. And these things, if you could take a time machine back to the third and final part of the age of dinosaurs, the Cretaceous period, and walk through a forest, say 120 million years ago, you'd see lots of birds, flitting about in the trees, probably singing to each other, catching bugs, things like this. These animals, these birds, and enantiornithine birds, these were the dominant birds of the Cretaceous. But interestingly enough, they went completely extinct at the end of this period. So think about that for a second. Most people that know something about the age of dinosaurs and the extinction that happened at the end of the age of dinosaurs, they know that what we call non-avian dinosaurs, things like Tyrannosaurus rex and Triceratops and my creature Anzu, the chicken from hell, these things went extinct at the end of the age of dinosaurs. But alongside those more famous animals were entire groups of birds that also went extinct. And the enantiornithes were the most prominent among them. So this group of birds was extraordinarily diverse during the age of dinosaurs, and yet, like their non-avian dinosaur cousins, these things were wiped out completely at the end of the age of dinosaurs and left no descendants. So we're not going to talk about them anymore during this talk, but suffice it to say that this was an extraordinary radiation, a very abundant group of birds that died out and left no descendants at the very end of the age of dinosaurs. So poor Enantiornithines, rest in peace to Enantiornithines, and we'll talk about now the lineage that led to modern birds. Now, not too long after Archaeopteryx was discovered, there were fragments of birds that were quite closely related to modern birds discovered, and these animals are called Ichthyornis and Hesperornis. These are both birds that lived near an ancient inland ocean in what's now Kansas, and probably would have fed extensively on fish. And so these guys are kind of doing their own thing, but they are closely related to modern birds. So when we add them in to the we add them into the fossil record here, and also in Liaoning province, the same province that yielded those extraordinary feathered dinosaurs, in recent years we've also had discoveries of primitive members of the modern lineage that led to modern birds, these ornithuromorph birds. And these are several species of those. And so when we add this in, when we add all the, you know, everything that we knew about these animals up until the point when I was in graduate school, the gulf in fossil bird evolution was about 40 million years long. So when my collaborators and I got interested in this question, there was still a span of time that's almost as long as the entire age of mammals, where we had almost no fossils, almost no information on how you go from something like an Archaeopteryx to something like a modern bird. In other words, a 40 million year gap in bird evolution. And this is where, in a small way, the research that my colleagues and I have done comes in. It starts with a bird called Gansis. Gansis was originally known from just this specimen here. And it's just a fossil foot. I think you can see the toes. You can see this is the foot bone, and then even part of the ankle here. That's all there was known of Gansis. Now, Gansis was one of these, like many discoveries in paleontology, Gansis was completely serendipitous when it was found. It was found in 1981 by a group of paleontologists that study fossil fishes. Believe it or not, all of us paleontologists specialize in different animal groups. And there are people that, you know, say, hey, I'm just going to study fossil fish. I'm going to study fossil birds. I'm going to study fossil crocodiles, and so on. A group of paleontologists studying fossil fishes were looking for fossil fishes in an area of northwestern China, in northwestern Gansu province, called the Changma Basin. And this is a really, really beautiful place. Probably part of the reason these guys went to these deposits, in addition to looking for fossil fish, is just because the place is extraordinarily beautiful. When my team and I first went there in 2004, all we could think about was, and most of you guys have probably seen these movies, all we could think about was the Shire in the Lord of the Rings movies, because it's so beautiful. It's in, you know, this beautiful golden fields of grain, you know, surrounded by forests and rocks and snow-capped peaks off in the distance. These mountains here are the northernmost extent of the Tibetan Plateau that was created when India smashed into Asia, beginning about 50 million years ago. So a really, really cool place to work. These fossil fish experts were digging in rocks of the Shago Formation, which is not, of course, not the grain in the foreground. It's these rocks in the background here. And this is a really extraordinary set of rocks. It was deposited on an ancient lake bed. And of course, like you see in modern environments, you know, if you were to take a core of a bottom of a lake, you would see that the sediment layers are deposited more or less horizontally. But when we look at the rocks of the Shago Formation, due to processes related to that uplift of that Tibetan plateau, the smashing of India into Asia some 50 million years ago, these rocks have been tilted up almost vertically. And so when you're standing there looking at these rocks and peeling them back layer by layer, it's almost like you're turning the pages of history. Try not to get too poetic and cheesy about it, but it is literally like that. It's a really amazing place to work. Now, these rocks, And this bird, Gansis humanensis, that was found, again, accidentally by these fossil fish experts in 1981 and described in 1984, it was long known that these rocks dated to the early part of the Cretaceous period, the third and final period of the Age of Dinosaurs, which, on the whole, extended for 80 million years, about 146 million years ago to 66 million years ago. And it was long known that these rocks dated to the early part of the Cretaceous period. More recently, we've been able to determine that they probably belong to the Aptian stage. So they're about 115 million years ago or so. So that's really interesting. That was really interesting from our perspective. We had, you know, again, this 40 million year gap in bird evolution with these animals that are about 125 million years old to animals that are about 85 million years old, and really not too much in between. That's what this slide is meant to show you. And when I was in graduate school, my colleague Hailu Yu and I, we started to wonder, where does Gansis fit into this picture? And that was a really, really difficult question to answer because, as I said, Gansis was known only from a single fossil foot for many, many years. And just like, you know, picture yourself an anatomist, somebody studying, a particular group of animals or plants. The more you've got of that creature, that organism, the more you're likely to be able to learn about it. And so, you know, going from just a fossil foot is quite difficult. I mean, there's only so much you can tell about a given animal when you've only got that little bit of it. So Hailu, my colleague Hailu Yu, he got this idea in his head that maybe it would be productive, scientifically productive, to go back to the Chang Ma Basin and try to find more of Gansis or whatever could be found. So in 2002, Hailu and his team went back to the Chang Ma Basin, and he took a small team of researchers. It's only about maybe, you know, six or seven people. They only worked there for about a week. But in that short amount of time, they found this little slab, and you can see they're all really happy. Hailu looks especially awesome there because he's got his big beard going. He usually doesn't have that. I always tell him he should grow that out because it looks pretty cool. and the thing they found was, you know, sort of an unassuming little fossil, but something that had very, very, you know, substantial scientific significance. It was this... Again, sort of unintelligible looking thing. You'll have to believe me when I tell you this is the shoulder and arm of a type of bird from about 115 million years ago. And my throat's getting a little bit dry, so I have a solution for that problem. Hope you all do too. This bird, or this fossil, about 115 million years old. And interestingly, you know, in addition to being the second fossil bird that had ever been found from the Chang Ma Basin, it actually belonged to a different kind of bird, these enantiornithines, these opposite birds. And so this was extraordinarily encouraging to Hailu and I. Hailu came back to the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, where we were both graduate students. And he came to me and he said, "Matt, I found this, you know, I found the second fossil bird that's ever been found in the Chang Ma Basin." And this is where some of my previous research experience came into play. So a couple of years before, another fellow graduate student of mine and I got really, really lucky. We had this research project in Egypt, and we were able to convince a TV company to give us all the money we needed to do the field work, and all they wanted in return was the right to make a TV show about it. And so, you know, I'm 24 years old. You know, I get to be on TV. I'm like, you know, this is like my dream coming true in front of me. It was like, you know, where do we sign? And so when Hailu found this bird in the Chang Ma Basin, he knew that I had experience getting funding from unusual sources of funding, you know, like television companies. And so he came to me and he said, "Well, I've got this great project, and do you want to come along for the ride?" And I said, "Well, sure. If I can find this funding to help you out, I would love to." And so basically, we had Hailu with his extraordinary fossil, and me with, you know, a few connections, I guess, to people in the entertainment industry, I guess. And And so as it turns out, I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and that's the headquarters of places like National Geographic, places like the Discovery Channel. And so I would take, you know, about three or four different times, I hopped on the D.C. Metro, and I went down to the headquarters of the Discovery Channel, and I met with a woman there, and I pleaded with her to give us money, you know, and I just said, you know, this is going to be, we think this will be pretty exciting, you know, I can't guarantee we're going to find anything, but we've already found something, so, you know, give us the money we need to do our project. And thankfully, I think she probably just got tired of having me come there. But she did eventually give us enough money to do a field season. And so in 2004, Hailu and I found ourselves in the Chiang Mai Basin, as, you know, and in the hope of looking for more fossil birds. And I always told the people at the Discovery Channel, you know, I have no idea what we're going to find. I mean, you know, this could be like a, you know, a totally colossal bust, you know, like when, you know, what is it, every 10 years somebody thinks they find Jimmy Hoffa, or, you know, like they want to open up Al Capone's vault, or, you know, I mean, any, or, you know, people that go hunting for UFOs or something like this. I mean, I tried to tell them, I can't guarantee you we're going to find anything. So if you give us this money, you just got to do it on, out of interest in the research. And she was like, okay, I understand. So you can imagine how excited I was when we got to the Chiang Mai Basin. Hailu had sent a group of about five people before our team that were already digging there for about a week when we got there. And they had already found a single fossil bird. And I actually brought a copy of that very first specimen. It's a little bit hard to see, but you guys are all welcome to come up and look at this. It's a cast, so you can't, you know, the original's in China, so you're not going to do any harm to it. But this was interesting. So the first, this is a copy of the third fossil bird specimen that was ever discovered from the Chiang Mai Basin, these 115 million-year-old rocks in northwestern China. And since I've got this in front of me, I'll tell a little joke about it. So as this fossil was being cleaned off, Hailu and I could see, and I have to admit, we were a little bit disappointed about this. Hailu and I could see that the feet, that what we had was a pair of feet. And, you know, I think you guys can see that even probably from up there. We've got, you know, here's one foot and here's the other. And as this was being prepared, we noticed that it looked exactly like the feet of Gansus humanensis. In other words, we very probably had another specimen of Gansus. And so remember that the first specimen of Gansus was just a single foot. And so I said to Hailu, I go, well, you know, we didn't find a new species, but at least now we know that Gansus has 2 feet. And Hailu said, at least 2. So, yeah. So, thanks for the applause. I'll be here all week. So that was our first fossil, and we were so excited about that because that, you know, that meant we had paid the Discovery Channel bills. You know, we could find nothing for the rest of the trip, and everything would be okay. But thankfully for us, we did not just get skunked for the rest of the trip. We actually had a really, really, really gigantic amount of good luck, and that's why when you see our faces in this picture, we're smiling from ear to ear. In August, I think it was August 8, 2004, you know, we're digging at Chiang Mai, and we hadn't found anything since that first, you know, the first specimen of Gansus, the 2 feet that someone else had found. We hadn't found anything. We're digging there for about a week, and we're, you know, starting to get a little bit frustrated that, you know, we're probably not going to find anything else. Well, at least we've got the Gansus with 2 feet, so that's good. On August 8th, 2004, Hailu pulls up in the Jeep, and I'm busily digging away in this quarry and not really finding anything. I might find a fossil plant here and there, maybe a bug here and there, and things like this, but not too much of consequence. Hailu pulls up in the Jeep, and he says, "Would you like to see the bird?" And I look at him like, you're full of crap. And he's like, no, I'm serious. And okay. So I run up the side of this hill I was actually at a quarry that's at the down here on the road, so I would have been a little bit off the screen over here. I run up this hill, and as I get up to the top of the hill, I see laid out before me at least 2 or 3 fragments of fossil birds, and this was really, really exciting. So what had happened was we had one of our teams digging on the other side of the road, not really finding much of anything, finding even less than we did, and then all of a sudden they hit a layer, maybe about, you know, say 2-3 feet thick, that was just chock full of fossil birds. And this is a shot. It was my attempt at being like, you know, good photo composition. You know, here you got the nice sweet thing in the foreground and then some nice mountains in the background. I didn't make it as a National Geographic photographer. I tried. But a wing of a fossil bird here, and then off into the Chiang Mai Basin there. But at this site, bird fossils were coming out of the ground at an extraordinary rate, and we were so excited. We again remember from this place, this Chiang Mai Basin, this had yielded only 2 fragments of birds in all of history, and so the fact that we were finding more was really exciting to us. We ended up digging a lot more at that site, and we ended up making the hole a lot bigger than it was. And there's some people up there to show you how big this hole turned out to be. Nowadays, it's even quite a bit bigger than that. From the Chiang Mai Basin, in this place that had yielded 2 bits of fossil birds in all of history, we found more than 30 that first summer alone. And so we were really, really, really stoked. So here's another example of one of these guys. This is a copy of the fossil that's on the lower left there. So you can come up and see it for yourself. I think I often bring these copies of these fossils because people, when they hear I'm going to be talking about the origin of birds from dinosaurs, they think that, they think I'm going to like lead a T-Rex in by the nose or something like this. Fossil birds, even birds from the age of dinosaurs, they were already mostly small, and so that's another interesting thing about bird evolution. And I think when a lot of people think about the transition from dinosaurs to birds, many people often think, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I can't really imagine a T-Rex growing feathers and starting to fly. Well, the answer is we've got all of these animals that fill in that evolutionary gap. And so it's definitely not, things like T-Rex are related to birds, but only very distantly. So we've got a whole mess of other creatures, and then some of which I showed you. But in 2004 alone, we found about 30 partial to nearly complete birds, and that was fantastic. Even better than that was, for the first time ever, we found soft tissues preserved with some of these birds from the Chiang Mai Basin. So many of these birds have things like feathers, things like skin. The skin of one particular specimen is going to come into play a little bit later when I talk about the lifestyle of Gansis. Since 2004, we've continued to go back. We realized we inadvertently stumbled on a paleontological gold mine at the Chiang Mai Basin, and we've continued to go back. In fact, Hailu's going back this summer. We now have upwards of 100 partial to nearly complete birds from this site, and it's proven this wealth of information about the birds that were living there about 115 million years ago, including some animals that are related to the origins of modern birds. In other words, animals that help us fill in that help us answer the questions that we posed in the first place. Most of our fossils belong to Gansis, this bird that was first discovered there in 1981, that was known from only a fossil foot. We now have pretty much the whole skeleton of this bird, thanks to this wealth of material that we've got. In fact, as of our last paper on Gansis, which was actually, it's getting quite a while ago now, our first paper on Gansis, we had everything except for the skull and neck. And I can't give away too much, but I can tell you that we've got that part now as well. But back when we published this paper, this is what we had. The bones in white are what we had. So remember that initially, Gansis was known from a single foot. Now we had almost the whole thing, which meant that we could tell a lot more about the evolutionary relationships, the appearance, the biology of this animal for the first time. When we use this new these new specimens to try to figure out the evolutionary relationships of this animal, we got Gansis to come out in an extraordinarily advanced position. Gansis seems to be, even now, 8 years later, Gansis seems to be, and this is not just analyses of my own, these are analyses of my colleagues as well, it seems to be the most advanced bird from the early Cretaceous period. So in other words, for a chunk of time that's about 50 million years long, this thing is the closest thing we've got to things like chickens and geese and ducks and ostriches and all these birds that we see around us today. So that was an unexpected and awesome outcome of this work, something that we didn't really anticipate. Gansis seems to be on the line to modern birds, an effectively anatomically modern bird from the early Cretaceous period. So in many ways, Gansis fills in this gap in our knowledge of bird evolution, this gap that we were working with back in 2004. And of course, you know, Ganses itself doesn't completely bridge this gap, but it forms a nice link in the chain that helps to solve that question. But even more interestingly, I think, about Ganses was what we were completely unexpectedly able to find about its ecology. And this is a very unassuming fossil. This is not one of our prettiest fossils. It probably doesn't look like much. I'm looking at everybody's faces, and many people are kind of like, what is that thing? It turns out it's a pair of legs, legs from the shin down. So here's the knee, you have to imagine two bird legs pressed together, squished on the bottom of a lake and covered by thousands of tons of sediment for 115 million years, and you've got a pretty good idea. Here's the shin, the ankle here, these are the feet, and the 2 feet are kind of wrapped together, and that's sort of what you're seeing there. And I'm showing you this fossil not for the bones, but for something that's very, very cool that's preserved between the toes. So we're going to zoom in on the toes, and I think maybe you can start to see it now. I'll try to highlight it with these arrows. Hopefully you can see this. This specimen of Ganses has something very unusual preserved between its toes. Something that's distinctly different from the rock. Something that's undoubtedly there, undoubtedly fossil. It turns out that when you put this under a microscope, you see lots and lots and lots of little scales. You also see that these scaly areas go from toe to toe. They connected the toes when this animal was alive. There's something that looks like this today. And we call them... That was awesome. somebody quacked, for anybody that didn't hear that. We call them webs. And this is something... I mentioned, these scientific discoveries. Every now and then you're fortunate enough to make or be a part of a scientific discovery that just bashes you over the head. Like something that you don't need to be a scientist to have figured out. When we found webs between the toes of Ganses, it was that proverbial 2x4 over the head. It was, hey, idiots, your bird is an aquatic bird. And so we started to look for more features of aquatic birds in Ganses, and it turns out they're all over the skeleton. It's got a number, I cut these slides out trying to keep this talk shorter, but it's got a vast number of features that are shared with aquatic birds. Interestingly, when we map the ecology of birds onto this evolutionary tree, we came up with this pretty interesting pattern. The ancestors of modern birds, these early branches off the avian evolutionary tree, I talked about some of these guys already, but this group is the Velociraptor group. Here's Archaeopteryx. Here's our old friend Confucius ornus, that very early bird from China. These Enantiornithines, these opposite birds. These are predominantly animals that are thought to have lived on land, and we know that from a number of different lines of evidence, many of which are anatomical. They've got features of animals that live on land. Interestingly, when we get closer to the modern bird lineage, we see that Ganses is the rule rather than the exception. Many of these creatures are known to have lived in aquatic environments. And so you get this nice sequence of terrestrial creatures, animals that were living on land, into aquatic creatures, animals that were living in and near water. And some of these, Ganses has webbed feet. This creature here, Yanornis, this creature here, has been found, literally specimens of this have been found with fish stuck in their throat. They died trying to eat, they literally bit off more than they could chew and died trying to swallow fish. Another great indicator that you're probably living in and near water quite a lot of the time. And of course, modern birds do all kinds of things. They're this massive radiation that's inhabited just about every ecological niche you can think of. But when we saw this pattern, this kind of raised this interesting question to us. We've got this sequence of aquatic creatures on the line to modern birds, and that raises the question, ultimately, the ancestor of every single bird that we see around us today, could that have evolved in an aquatic environment, a lake, a river, a stream, something like this? And I think that this is something that we advanced in a paper in 2006, and it's yet to be universally accepted, but it's yet to be overturned as well. So I would describe it as still an open question, a reasonable hypothesis, certainly not something that's been proven, but certainly something that hasn't been disproven either. And so it's one of these interesting things that as we continue to discover fossils, hopefully we'll be able to understand this a little bit better and maybe get more evidence one way or the other. Right now, it's an interesting pattern. From there, I'm going to take us very far away from China. I'm going to take us to the other side of the world, to Antarctica, and talk a little bit more. And I put this in here just so you guys know I'm still doing research. I keep talking about things that happened back in 2004 and 2002 and things like this. This is what I've been doing in recent years, is this work in Antarctica. And you might wonder, you know, why is this dinosaur paleontologist, this guy that hunts for dinosaurs, going to Antarctica, continents mostly covered in ice? You know, Antarctica, what's up? You know, I mean, is he going to go down there and look at penguins? Why would you do that? We've got those here in Pittsburgh. So hopefully they're doing well, right? I guess they probably just started. So they are? Okay, good. Somebody checking their phone? Well, the answer is there's actually a lot of reasons why we go to Antarctica, and I'll tell you a little bit about them. Again, I mentioned that Gansis is quite closely related to modern birds, but it's not quite a modern bird itself. And there's an interesting question, a huge question in bird evolution, is when did the modern bird group appear? In other words, when did this group that contains all 10,000 species of living birds, when did this group appear? There's two different ways to reconstruct evolutionary relationships. And sometimes people combine them, but there's sort of two different main ways. One is to sort of look at the fossil record and try to infer the history of groups from that. Down here, this K means Cretaceous, this T means Tertiary. This is another name for the Paleogene. If you look at the fossil record of modern birds, it implies that probably they weren't very diverse, and then they diversified very explosively right after the end of the age of dinosaurs. In other words, to think about it in maybe a simple way, you know, big things like T-Rex and Triceratops and all these dinosaurs keel over, all these enantiornithines, these opposite birds keel over, all of a sudden there's all this ecological space available all over on Earth, and modern birds diversify, radiate, and fill in the space, and that's what gives us the bird radiation that we have today. There's another way to look at bird relationships, and that's by taking their DNA and comparing it across different bird groups. And when you do that, and you estimate the ages at which these things diverged, and I hope nobody asked me that question, because that's a very tough one to answer for me, at least. Suffice it to say that when you look at bird evolution in this fashion, it gives you a different conclusion, and that's that much of the history, much of the evolution of modern birds actually took place during the age of dinosaurs. So we've got this conflict. We've got fossils on one side saying that the modern bird group really wasn't around very much or maybe even at all during the age of dinosaurs. And we've got this information on the other side from the genealogical relationships, the DNA of modern birds that suggests that there were a lot of birds around, modern birds around during the age of dinosaurs. This is a big paradox. And so the question becomes, was the modern bird group around during the age of dinosaurs? Was the modern bird group around in the Cretaceous period, the third and final period of the age of dinosaurs? In other words, was there a Cretaceous origin of modern birds? Did things like ducks and geese and chickens and ostriches live alongside things like T-Rex and Triceratops? Very interesting question, and something that, you know, when you think about the age of dinosaurs, you probably think, you know, T-Rex and volcanoes and, you know, things like Brontosaurus. As it turns out, there were much more familiar-looking animals present there as well. So, did modern birds originate in the Cretaceous? Well, to go there, or to answer that question, one of the best places to go is Antarctica, and I'll tell you why. The Antarctic Peninsula, this little prong of Antarctica that juts up towards South America, although it looks like this today, this is a shot of us in the field in 2009, it looked like this during the age of dinosaurs. It was a much warmer place. The peninsula was bordering a shallow ocean that absolutely teemed with life. Many different kinds of creatures, including lots and lots of kinds of birds. In particular, the area that we're interested in is on the Antarctic Peninsula, and it's called the James Ross Basin. And the James Ross Basin is occupied primarily by these four islands. The rocks are called the Lopez de Bertzano Formation, and they date to the very end of the age of dinosaurs, what's called the Maastrichtian stage. The last gasp of the age of dinosaurs before, you know, the big asteroid hit or the volcanoes exploded or whatever, you know, whatever mechanism killed off the non-avian dinosaurs before this happened. So these are animals that are living here are literally some of the last creatures alive during the age of dinosaurs. From this island called Vega Island comes another one of these sort of unassuming fossils. A fossil that, you know, sort of only a mother could love. It doesn't look like much of anything. It's a bunch of fragmentary bones in a boulder. But when you look at this, when somebody that knows what they're doing looks at this, in particular, when a very intelligent, very, very smart colleague of mine named Julia Clark looked at this, she realized this for what it was. This is, on the left is the rock itself. On the right is a CT scan, an X-ray of the rock. And this rock contains much of the skeleton of a single bird individual. When you study this animal in detail, you see a lot of features in common with modern birds. And this animal turned out to be a new species that Julia named Vagavis, and it's this creature here. Vagavis, when she put this into an evolutionary analysis, the results turned out to be pretty surprising. Vagavis seems to be, effectively, a Cretaceous duck. Cue quack. Sorry, I don't know who quacked, but that would have been a great time for a quack. So Vagavis is a Cretaceous duck, effectively. And even better than that, so we had Vagavis being, a duck or a duck-like bird. This is a bird that's a member of a modern bird group, the only one from the age of dinosaurs. But it even gets better than that. From this island called Seymour Island comes a bird called Polar Ornis. And this bird is thought to be a Cretaceous representative of the loon lineage. So if this is true, we've got two different modern bird groups represented at the end of the age of dinosaurs. And so that's pretty interesting. This is the only place in the world where members of the modern bird group have been found from the age of dinosaurs. So we don't go to Antarctica because I really like getting on a boat and floating around for 4 days, or camping on an uninhabited island in freezing temperatures for 3 weeks. We do it because the chances of finding something extraordinary are very high there. And so these fossils from Antarctica, these two bird fossils tell us definitively that yes, the modern bird group was around at the end of the age of dinosaurs. In other words, modern birds were alive when things like Tyrannosaurus rex was alive, things like Triceratops was alive, duck-billed dinosaurs, the chicken from hell, you name it. These modern birds were living at the same time as some of these much more classic kinds of dinosaurs. And the only place we've ever found them is in Antarctica. So when you've got, it's almost to a paleontologist, it's almost like a treasure map. X marks the spot. We've got modern birds in Antarctica, so why not? Let's go and try and find some more. So the question becomes, if we only find members of the modern bird group in Antarctica at the end of the age of dinosaurs, is it just possible that Antarctica, this continent at the end of the world, this frozen wasteland where almost nothing lives, could it have been the cradle, the area of origin of one of the most diverse groups of backboned animals alive today? In other words, just think for a second, is it possible that Antarctica may have been the place where the very first modern bird lived and ultimately gave rise to every single one of the 10,000 species that we see alive today? So, when you've got a circumstance like that, it begs the question, let's go try and find some more. So, in 2011, a bunch of colleagues and I, including, this is Julia Clark, the woman that described Vagavis to begin with, there's me, and there's a bunch of other colleagues of ours, went down to Antarctica in 2009 and 2011 to try to find more fossil bird material. And in particular, we went to two places. We went to a place called the Nays on James Ross Island and looked at a rock unit called the Snow Hill Island Formation. There, we didn't find any bird material, but we did actually find something that's, again, one of these really ugly fossils that nonetheless has some significance. This is, you're looking at the end of the toe of one of the 10 specimens of a non-avian dinosaur ever discovered from the end of the age of dinosaurs in Antarctica. So for an 80 million year chunk of Earth history, this is one of the 10 little tiny bits we've got of dinosaurs other than birds. And you're welcome to come up and look at this if you want. This is the real thing. This is the real fossil. And it's just the little end of the knuckle of the foot of a dinosaur that would have been probably about 10 feet long, would have grazed on plants at the end of the age of dinosaurs in Antarctica. This fossil actually comes from not from this particular site, but just down the beach right there on James Ross Island. But we spent most of our time on another island called Vega Island. This is the island that yielded the fossil of Vagabus to begin with. And we looked at rocks of the Lopez de Bertadano formation, which, as most people don't realize this, rocks on the Antarctic Peninsula can be very well exposed. And where you have well-exposed rocks, you can find the fossils in them if you look hard enough. And as you can see, there's an entire mountain full of fossils here in Antarctica. That's a person up there. So this is a huge bluff here that's just loaded with fossils. And we found many, many things when we were looking there in 2011. We found fossils of plants. This is something that's kind of cool. Think about Antarctica as this, effectively a frozen wasteland, almost no native vegetation. We found leaves of many different kinds of plants. And it was, keep in mind, it was a bunch of dinosaur paleontologists looking. There are actually people that specialize in the study of fossil plants, and they have their own techniques for collecting them. So the fact that a bunch of dinosaur people who don't really know what they're doing were able to find about 20 different species of plants suggests that there's probably a lot more out there. And interestingly, some of these things are very broadleaf things that you identify with things like temperate or even potentially subtropical forests. In other words, again, feeding into this idea that Antarctica was a much warmer place at the end of the age of dinosaurs. This was maybe the coolest plant discovery that we made. This is a single seed you guys have all seen during the fall, when the maple leaves drop their trees, they have these sort of helicopter-looking things. When this thing popped out of the rock, we're like, oh, it's a maple tree. It turns out to not be that, but it's something similar to that. That, again, implies a much warmer climate during this time. We found sharks. This is a tooth of a shark. We found bony fishes, so in other words, fishes except sharks. This is the backbone of one of those. We found marine reptiles. This particular thing is called a plesiosaur. These are the long-necked marine reptiles. We found dinosaurs. I already showed you the toe bone there. There it is, much larger, so it looks more impressive, We found a dinosaur tooth, but most excitingly and most importantly from our perspective, our dinosaur discoveries, they're interesting. They're worth a note, but you're not going to tell very much from a single toe bone. What was much more interesting were our discoveries of fossil birds. And these are three. I actually brought two of these three fossils for you guys to look at. Again, they don't look like much. They certainly don't look like the Chinese fossils where we've got almost whole birds laid out on slabs of rock. But they're nonetheless important. This is a vertebra from the back. Here's part of the foot. And here's a shoulder bone. But the best was yet to come, and we didn't realize we had it for many, many months. We had this sort of unusual-looking lump of rock in our collection that our geologist, Eric, founded. And yeah, the geologists, they always seem to find the best stuff, I think because they're out looking around. We paleontologists, we find something, we crouch down on our knees and we don't move again for 6 hours, because we're like brushing away or digging up a dinosaur or whatever. The geologists are always moving, and so they see tons and tons of rock, and they find a lot of different things. And this is a rock that Eric picked up, and he brought it back to camp, and he goes, well, hey, look, I see these... I see these sort of long linear impressions here, and I see, oh, there's something more back here. What could this be? And we all joked with each other, well, maybe it's a bird head and a rock. Well, guess what? It turns out to be a bird head and a rock. This was our, by far, our most important discovery in 2011. It's still under preparation. It's a little bit hard to interpret. This photo was taken a few months ago. We've exposed more of it since then. I just got the CT data back, so the CAT scan data back, and if I had time, I would have included this in here. But what you're looking at, we think, is imagine you take the head of a bird, you embed it in mud, break that ball of mud in half, and turn it over and look at it from the underside, and that's what we think we're looking at here. So the beak here, this is what's the palate. So there are different palatal bones exposed here. Here's the back of the skull, and you can just see part of it right there. We think that this is going to be one of the more important fossil bird discoveries from Antarctica that's ever been made, and so we're very, very excited about this. And hopefully it'll be published within the next year or two or so. So But I'm almost done. I just wanted to say that, of course, we're not satisfied with what we've discovered. We still have many, many more questions that we want answers to. And so thankfully, in 2012, I got a big grant that'll let us go back to Antarctica again to look for more fossil birds, look for dinosaurs, look for fossils of the animals and plants that were living with them, try to find more material of these things so we can figure out what they looked like, what they're related to, you know, what kinds of animals and plants lived with them, what the environment was like. All of these questions are things that we're very interested in. And so, with a little bit of luck, we've had two field seasons canceled already due to really, really terrible ice conditions down there in recent years. But with a little bit of luck, we'll get on this big orange ship and we'll sail across the Drake Passage for 4 days and we'll end up in Antarctica and hopefully find more fossils of birds and other kinds of creatures. Our target will be Vega Island once again, and hopefully we'll find, you know, the rest of the bird that gave us the head that we found, for instance. So, with a little bit of luck, there'll be more to come in the next couple of years. But for now, since I've gone a little bit longer than I wanted, I'm going to end there and turn it over to you guys' questions.